Welcome to our Voices in Montessori podcast. Dr. Montessori said, an education capable of saving humanity is no small undertaking. We agree. So let's get to work. I'm Tamara Sheasley-Ballas, and in today's episode, we're talking about how current brain research shapes our work in the Montessori classroom. I am so excited to have Julia Volkman here today. And Julie has been teaching children and mentoring teachers in private and public schools since 1997. She's a faculty member of the Brain Health Initiative, a guest lecturer for Harvard University's Neuroscience of Learning course, a Montessori mentor, and the founder and president of the educational project, Maitree Learning. Julia earned her AMI credential for 3-6 from the Montreal Montessori Training Center, and her master's degree from Harvard University. Her graduate research at Harvard on early literacy earned her the Dean's Prize for Outstanding Thesis, which I'm not surprised to hear. Her work focuses on transforming education into a transdisciplinary scientific pedagogy grounded in mind, brain, and education. We're so excited to have you here today, Julia. And so Julie and I we've known each other, I think it's about 15 years now, right?
Maybe longer. It's been a while.
Right. I was at Amherst Montessori School. I was running the school and we needed some support. And somebody said to me, you should be working with Julia Volkman. Don't you know Julia? And I didn't know Julia. And we brought you in and it was just such a gift to that guide. And then we brought you in here. When I started my tenure here and we brought Julie in to do full day workshops because what an impact on our community.
Nice of you to say. It was wonderful to work with your team. I have to say, I am so inspired by you, Tamara, and the work that you keep doing to bring Montessori forward and available to more people. It's really inspirational.
Oh, well, thank you. That is so nice of you to say. So well, so let's get into it. So we are going to talk today about how the research on the brain shapes what we're doing in the Montessori classroom. And so I just want to start with asking you, why should we as Montessorians really care about brain health? And how is brain research really relevant to what we're doing in our classrooms?
I am so glad you asked me that. Oh my gosh, it's insanely relevant. Okay, so the research is showing more and more that what we're doing when we're little influences not just our academics and capacity intellectually when we're older, but our health in general, our physical health, our longevity. It is so directly related to what we're doing when we're little. And it's adverse childhood events. If you do research and look into that, you can see that when you have difficulty in childhood, you have long-term difficulty in so many areas, not just in academics, not just in employability, but in diabetes and heart disease, all of these other areas. And so what we're doing with younger children and even all through development is just critically important for long-term well-being and health. It's not just about academics.
Can you talk about that a little bit more? That's such an interesting concept that the brain could actually make a difference in our diabetes. Like, why is that? Right? Can you help us connect that?
I know, it's crazy, right? Well, you have to remember that the brain is not separate from the rest of the body. The brain is part of biology. And when they first started the mind-brain education program at Harvard, Kurt Fisher, one of my professors and the founder of the program, he wanted to call it mind biology in education because biology is really what we're talking about. We're not talking about the brain really as a specific organ, but the brain is kind of the master controller for much of what's happening in our body, but it doesn't work in isolation. So the amount of the way we consume nutrition, the amount of sleep we're able to get, all of these things, the physical activity, especially what we're able to do, directly influence the function of our brain. And then that, of course, feeds back into the body and directly influences the health of the body. So let me just, I'll just give you an example with sleep, if you like.
Please, please.
So when we go to sleep, there's this whole system in our brain. They call it the glymphatic system because it's for all these glia, which are the other cells in the brain. There's neurons and there's glia. Those are kind of the big guys up in the brain, neurons and glia. And the glia are the hardest working ones, I think. We like to talk about neurons because everybody's geeky that way. But glia are the ones that do all of the support jobs. Mm. And when you go to sleep, you have what's called a glial wash. And it washes out all of these things that build up, these byproducts that build up in your brain over the normal course of the day. And if you wash them out well because you've had adequate sleep, then you're refreshed in the morning. You think clearly. And when you don't wash them out, you're leaving things in there like those plaques that contribute to dementia are staying in the brain and building up. And that's why sleep is so essential. And that's one example of how something we do in our lifestyle, our daily practice, dramatically influences our brain's health. Mm-hmm. And so what we're doing with children and what we're doing with families to educate and support them, it's not just about reading and writing and, you know, and arithmetic. It's about long-term well-being. And there's some research, I think Angelina Lillard has some research on well-being and Montessori. So we're starting to look at it from that clinical study perspective too, but you can see it. You can see it with your students, right?
Yes. That sense of balance that comes over the child who comes in and may not have really that have the skills of controlling their voice, modulating their voice or even their body. And then all of a sudden, a couple months in, you're watching this child and there's ease in their system.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I think you're talking about one of the key things is this development that happens both naturally, but also more effectively in an environment that's not stressful. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about ease, you're talking about that. Okay. I'm comfortable in this environment because I know what to expect. Mm-hmm. I know how it works and I know that I have agency. And so one of the key things I was hoping we could talk about today is self-efficacy and this sense of agency. And I think you just described it well. It's also development where the child, all of a sudden, they're starting to develop greater capacity, but they're in an environment that allows them to do that really effortlessly and skillfully without this extra stress, which is really toxic for brain development.
Mm. So can you talk about self-efficacy and how that would play out? Like I'm a guide in a children's house classroom. And I want to support the child's brain development and self-efficacy. What does that look like? Like practical skills that support their brain development.
So that's a great question. And I think the most important thing for us to do is to be keen observers, right? We have to notice what's happening with the child. And we have to scaffold them at the right level. And in the Montessori children's house, what we're doing is we're giving them all those preliminary exercises, right? All that work. So what do you need before you jump to the movable alphabet, right? You don't want to just throw them into the movable alphabet. First, you have to have sound games, lots and lots of sound games so they can segment. Then you have to have lots and lots of sandpaper letters so that they know at the second period, most of the letters and phonograms. And then you get to the movable alphabet because at each step, you're telling the child because the child is observing themselves. And so they're witnessing that they are able, that they are capable, that they can succeed with what's being asked of them. When we throw them in too far ahead, too soon, like, you know, you get the child is wandering around as a three-year-old who loves the beads, right? They're at the bead cabinet. They're like, they're taking out the beads. And you're like, well, I don't want to squelch their interest in the beads, but they can't do the beads yet. They can't even do the number rods, right? They can't do the beads. And so what do we do in that moment? We don't want to squelch their enthusiasm. We want to keep them engaged, but we cannot give them lessons that is going to decrease their self-efficacy. And that's what's going to happen when we give them materials that they're not prepared for. Mm-hmm. There'll be a subtle understanding in the child that they can't do it. And so in that situation, you're like, okay, we can dust the beads and you can teach them how to dust the beads so that you can still encourage their love for the beads. I love these beads too. These beads are the best. Let me show you how to dust them, you know? And that's how we can allow them to engage. But we have these subtle little ways of diminishing self-efficacy. We don't even notice. And it's like when you're having the three-year-old and you're giving them card material, like you want to do vocabulary lessons or matching lessons, and you're giving them card materials that has words written on it, but they can't read. So subtly, they're getting the message in themselves. No one's telling them this. But they're like, I can't really do this work because I don't understand part of what's in front of me.
And I'd heard before that you are putting those words out there so that they're inspired to read, right? Uh-huh. And that you're fueling their drive. But it sounds like that's not actually what's happening.
I think if you observe the children, you'll notice that it's a little different. And there's a subtle understanding that they're getting in themselves that they're not quite ready for it. They're only doing it halfway. They're not really doing the work. And if you observe for that, I think you'll notice it, which is why the recommendation is that we don't have words on the language cards before the child has the possibility of reading them. And once they have the possibility of reading them, give them all kinds of words, you know? I mean, inspire the heck out of them. But not until we think they can succeed. And that's kind of like when you think about putting on their shoe, right? We don't ask them to tie their shoe until we think they have the possibility of succeeding. Instead, we say, do the first part and we'll have them cross over the laces, you know, and then we watch the second part or whatever. And we slowly say, okay, now you can do the first part and the second part as they learn more. But we don't say sit down and tie your shoes if we've never showed them how.
That makes so much sense. And then what are you watching for in children? What are you observing for that tells you that they are actually having that experience of self-efficacy?
Oh, we all know it when we see it, right? Because all of a sudden they're focused, right? And then when they're done, they go like, they have like this joyful exhalation, you know, where they're just like, okay. And they just arise feeling good. Sense it in themselves. And I can't say feeling good because you can't observe that they're quote unquote feeling good. You have to observe their physical aspects, you know, are they smiling? Are they at ease? Are their shoulders down? Are their shoulders tight? Are their hands relaxed? You look at all of these physical parts. It's like when you're looking to see, you know, if a child is walking on their toes all the time, that's telling you that development is a little atypical. And so you're looking for the physical signs that would show you that the child feels successful.
That makes so much sense. So how does this relate to neuroplasticity?
Ah, great question. So neuroplasticity basically means anything we do repeatedly, the brain gets more efficient at. The brain is changing all the time based on what we do. And you can watch it actually in real time. Like they have videos, you know, of like you can see little dendritic branches growing and shrinking and growing and shrinking. And that all happens down at the neuronal level based on what we are experiencing and how we are applying ourselves, how we are engaging with our environment. So when we talk about neuroplasticity, it's just what Dr. Montessori said, that the mind is created through the work of the hand. Now, it's not just the hand, but it's the fact that the child is engaged actively in what they're doing in the environment. So passive learning is just not nearly as effective at forging strong brain pathways, neural pathways, right? So we need active learning. And we need that to be scaffolded. It's all about the right level of challenge at the right moment. Not too much, not too little. And some of the ways that we do that are this precision that we have in the way that we always start a lesson, right? What are the steps to starting a lesson? You always invite the child to work with you. You don't just say, you're doing this, right? You invite them. And of course, there's 10 different ways to invite a child. Like a three-year-old is just going to say, you know, or a 2.5-year-old, they're just going to say no, because that's what they do. So you don't say, would you like a lesson? You say, oh, it's time for your lesson. Let's go. You know, but there's still an invitation of some sort. The reason for that is because as the children develop, they may be in the middle of something that we didn't notice. And we want to give them the possibility of finishing. So we're not, I mean, how many times we do it all the time, right? We just go over because we're like, okay, this is the lesson I have to give. It's on my list. I'm going, all right, Shane, you're next. And then Kelly, and then you go, go, go.
Right.
And they're actually in the middle of an interaction with another student.
And
we don't know because we didn't have the time to observe that. So this invitation allows that moment and allows their own advocacy to develop. So again, self-efficacy is coming out in this when we talk about it. But this, so we're talking about plasticity, but I'm talking about the steps in the lesson. You're like, how does this all fit together? You're totally nuts, right? But it's like consistency. When the child knows how the environment works, what to expect, and has this structure, it's like a warm nest that they can relax in and really grow really well in. So it's this precise steps that we follow, like it's a choreographed dance, but we always adapt somewhat based on the audience.
And I remember, actually, I remember you telling me this 15 years ago, but every time you're asking the child to come to the lesson or inviting them to the lesson, it's like you're offering them an ice cream sundae.
Yeah.
Right? So that's right. I still remember, and you can imagine the experience of a child being invited to an ice cream sundae. And what that does to actually engage the brain in what they're about to do and have them be motivated and curious about what's about to happen. So I these things that you say stay with us, Julia.
It is, though. It's like a Japanese tea ceremony. It's like a sacred event. And when we approach it, the big reason to understand the dramatic influence we have on child development through the work that we're doing is because it helps us realize the sacred nature of our work. Every time we approach the child, we are just part of their life forever. An indelible part of their life will be coming. And we can do that skillfully or we can do that unskillfully.
That's really beautiful. I love that. And I love really acknowledging the sanctity of the Montessori classroom and the and the relationship between the guide and the child and the children and each other. So you that actually leads us into how many paths there are to mastery in the classroom. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
That's right. There's not just one path. So when we think about learning traditionally, we think, okay, you do X, you do Y, you do Z, and then you're going to get to the goal, right? That's the three steps and then you're there. But that's not how learning actually works. The way that we learn is really dynamic. And that's one of the great strengths of the Montessori classroom, because we're not just teaching language, you know, through a workbook. We teach it through cultural materials, through geography cards, through fine art card, you know, fine art experiences. We teach it from all areas of the environment of the child's world. And that's really essential to open them up and have a dynamic view of what's happening. Because even though Tamara may need to do X, Y, and Z to learn how to read, Julia may need A, B, C, D, and Y. to learn how to read, because there's some things that are straightforward, like yes, you have to have vocabulary, yes, you have to have letter sound awareness and phonemic awareness, right? And then you have to learn how to link letters together. But in order to write, you have to have the desire to write. You have to be inspired to write. You have to have something to write about, and you have to be able to express your ideas logically. And how do those things arrive in one child's life? Not one way.
And how do we fuel that? I mean, that's that's the big question, I think, that often guides have. They've got, you know, this five-year-old who they can't connect with writing. They're, the child's not taking to it the way the other third years are. And what do you advise in that case?
That's a great question. And the first thing I always say is observe, 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 and look back to your record keeping, look back to your lessons. Often in those cases, there's a couple things that could be happening. One is that we missed something. Another is that we moved them too soon. And another is that they have atypical development. So it's not, you know, we can't, biology and environment go hand in hand. They call it epigenetics, is the way the environment influences our genes, influences our biology. you cannot separate your genetics from your influences from your environmental influences. Mm-hmm. They go hand in hand. It's like you can carry the breast cancer gene and never get breast cancer, mm-hmm. right? It's your environment has influenced a lot of things. But if you're born with certain genetic challenges, you are stuck with some genetic challenges. We have no way at this point in time to get rid of them, right? Mm-hmm. We can learn to work with what we have, mm-hmm. right? So I think there's a couple of things it's such a big question and about how do you help the children who don't seem to be where you expect them to be. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely look at what you've given them, look at if you move them too fast, and also look at the child. And are you accepting them for who they are and what their capacities are? Are you inspiring them mm-hmm. to overcome the challenges that they have? I love to talk about this research. It's a little older, it's from the 90s. But it's out of Lesley University. And the researcher was curious about dyslexia and why there were so many astrophysicists and Nobel-winning scientists who had dyslexia, severe mm-hmm. dyslexia. And so she interviewed them. This was Rosalie Fink. She interviewed them and she found out, she's like, how could you excel in a reading intensive field when you have severe dyslexia? And for every single one of them, it was because they were so interested in the subject matter.
Yeah.
That's what they could overcome because they wanted to know.
Mm-hmm. They were motivated.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about this more dynamic learning path and neuroplasticity and influencing it skillfully rather than unskillfully, we're talking about knowing the child in front of us mm-hmm. and not expecting them all to look the same.
And there's something you talked about, making sure you're not pushing them too fast. I've also had the experience of guides holding a child and for too long and then they lose their curiosity in an area. They're waiting for this level of mastery that the child actually may not attain.
Well, there's a couple of views of that. There's one is that the child actually is ready and isn't able to demonstrate it in the way you're thinking they'll be able to demonstrate it. Mm-hmm. So I have an example of this when I had a student, Jake, who came to me when he was three, and when he came into the classroom, he would say hello, because I said hello to everybody, of course, in the morning. I was like, good morning, because you want to see the child. Are they exhausted? You know, are they upset? Is everything okay? And just greet them and get them inspired. Oh, there's something new in the geography folders, right? So you greet them. Jake would greet me every morning, and then he would run straight up. We had a little loft in our room, which was for resting. He would run straight up to the loft, lie down, suck his thumb, and watch, right? And that's what he did, right, for about the first 6 weeks of school. And I was really, like, starting to worry. And he was only three, right?
Right.
And so I'm like, there's so much I need to be doing with you. And I could do little things, but not too much. But he was watching everything. Finally, the day happens. Things shifted in him. He comes into the classroom, and he starts taking out the math material. And I'm like, I have not given him a math lesson. He's three, right? I've barely had, practical life, early language, right? That's what I'm trying to get in with him. He takes the number rods and he aligns them perfectly, and he gets the number cards and he counts them and he matches the number cards to the number perfectly, perfectly.
Wow.
He was watching. Mm-hmm. He was watching the other lessons. And even though I'm like, he's three, I'm not going to give him the number rods. He hasn't done the red rods. You know what I mean? He showed me that he was there. Mm-hmm. He was ready. Now, I did later back up and give him the red rods and the other preliminary activities. I wanted to make sure, just so there weren't any gaps. But I had to follow him and not be overly attached to order. You have to have flexibility with the child.
Well, and Dr. Montessori told us that. She was so clear that she didn't want us to get so deeply attached to what we felt like it had to look like, that we stopped following the spirit of the child.
That's right.
And
that's right.
And I think it's easy to get kind of caught in that too. And it's, we walk a tightrope as guides, right? Because we have to know, we've got to be up on brain research, right? We need to know what's really happening. We need to know what they're ready for next. We need to stretch them, hold them in this, that safe, you know, inspired place, and have room for their spirit. And I think it's part of what makes Montessori just such an amazing profession is we will grow in it forever. Yeah. You can be a Montessorian for 40 years and still be growing and learning.
Yeah. And I think the key thing in all of that that you're bringing up is that we have to follow the child's interest. So we have to know the children. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you get the child and all they care about is tractors. You know, we've had this child, right? They're like, they're just like talking, or they're talking about car models and they know all the car models, something like that. You got to get those vocabulary products out in your environment. You have to bring some their interest into the environment so that they can engage and connect. And once they get that original concentration and connection, then the sky's the limit. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. It's really capitalizing on those things that are they're interested in while they're really building those neural pathways. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Because when we're young, we have this thing called effortless plasticity. Like we just exist and our brain's like, oh, that's perfect. That's perfect. Neural network. It's building networks like crazy. Mm-hmm. And as we get older, we always have neuroplasticity. It doesn't go away, but it takes us more effort to implement it. Mm-hmm. So that's why it takes us longer maybe to learn a language. We can still learn a language when we're, you know, in our 50s, 60s, 70s, whenever we can learn one, but it will take us more effort. We'll have to be more consistent. Whereas the young child, you know, sometimes that's why we call them life's little tape recorders, right? Because they hear you talking to your sister and then they, you know, you said something quietly, barely, and then they tell everybody, right? Mm-hmm. That's neuroplasticity, that effortlessly absorb it.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And then can you talk about and I know this is a separate topic and I know that we're, you know, we don't have so much more time, but I'd love to have you talking about how we as guides overcome our natural negativity bias.
Oh, that's a big one, right? Yeah. Does everybody know about negativity bias? Is that?
No, I don't. I think that would be something great to bring our listeners.
So negativity bias is something, it's in kind of a new area of research, but if you think about it, you'll know that it's true because our brain pays more attention to tricky things. Mm. To help us survive. So like when something happens and there's a, you know, that you slip on the ice, right? You trip on the stairs, right? Mm. Your brain is going to pay extra attention to that. And so the next time you see ice or the next time you're on stairs, you are going to approach it a little differently because that matters for your safety, for your survival, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to notice it. So the brain is intelligently biased to notice difficult things and to pay extra attention to them. The challenge is that we don't want to develop unskillful patterns of thinking. So when we talk about plasticity, we're talking not just about in repetition, practice makes permanent. We're talking about repeating anything the brain repeats, it does more efficiently. That includes patterns of thinking. So our patterns of thinking are where our negativity bias can come in. If we're focusing again and again on, oh, she said this, and I'm no good, and I'm the worst, and I keep messing up, right? The brain gets very efficient at thinking in those ways, and it becomes the automatic. So we have to train ourselves to think more skillfully, you know, and be our own coach, be like, I'm working on it. There's a baby step. You know, if you're recovering from an injury, you're like, okay, I can put a little more weight on it today, right? Baby steps. Mm-hmm. Notice the small things that you're able to do to recover. And so our focusing on the positive is critical. When we talk about this in terms of the classroom, you think about the child who comes in and you know, they're just touching everybody's work. Mm-hmm. Right? We know this child. They run around the class, they're touching everything, right? Or there's the other child who's talking nonstop, right? Or there's the other child who won't say anything and just, you know, smacks or bites or something, right? These are all, we know these children. And this is normal. It's not a problem. We don't want it, right? But it's not a problem because it just means instead of saying this child's a disaster, we have to recognize this child's executive functions are just developing. Mm-hmm. And so we reframe that, you know, I cannot help this child. This child is totally out of control. Reframe that into a term, a phrase that's more accurate and allows us to be helpful. Because we know if they're just developing their executive functions, okay, they need more work, practice with inhibitory control. We do grace and courtesy, right? Mm-hmm. To help them learn how not to smack somebody when they're mm-hmm. talking mm-hmm. with them. So we break it down into those things. And again, that's switching from the negative to the positive, more of an optimism bias, which is much better for our long-term well-being.
And the child's.
100%. So if you're in the classroom and you're constantly, you know, you have the child, I'll call him, you know, the universal David, right? He's ready and he's trouble. You're like, oh my gosh, I can't turn my back for a second. There's going to be something. If you always are going, David, cut that out. All of the kids, you'll see it. All of the kids, as soon as something happens, they're going to go, David did it. David. And they will automatically do it because they're repeating you. And then what does that do to David? He's getting repetition that he's the problem. Mm-hmm. And what does it do to the other children? Repetition that they are not responsible. Mm-hmm. They had nothing mm-hmm. to do with it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's why for us, we have to reframe that thinking because we cannot be calling out and shaming the children. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We must find skillful ways to do it. So instead, and I have another story to tell you. I had this boy, he was in my class, this David, name wasn't David. And I had to keep him with me. I talked with my trainer. I'm like, I don't know what to do with this child. What am I going to do? And she says, you have to keep him close to you. You have to love him more than you love the rest of the children. Mm. And this was the first child who I didn't even think I liked. Like, I thought he was ugly and I love children. I've never seen an ugly child. And this child was like, I can't have him. So I had to fake it till I made it. And mm-hmm. I just had this child. I was like, oh, just come with me, David. Just come with me. And, you know, I just love it so much when you sit next to me. Would you sit next to me for this lesson? And I wasn't saying you're out of control when you're not with me, but that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. But I would never said that. And a few weeks after I started doing this, David was still tricky, maybe a little less tricky, but he's still really tricky. But I heard the other children said, she liked David so much. He's her favorite. And I thought, okay, it's working.
What a victory. And how the other children will treat him now as your favorite. You know, what a difference for his experience and how he sees himself. Talk about self-efficacy and the way they see themselves as leaders in the community rather than there's this, you can see it. You can see when a guide is dominating or punitive and brings that in because you see it in the older children in the classroom where they become the police, right? And there's this.
Yeah, that you, when you go into a classroom, you can just sit down and observe mm-hmm. and you'll know a lot about what's happening in the classroom pretty quickly mm-hmm. based on the children's behavior and how they interact with each other and what their attention is on. So attention is huge with the brain. Where we put our attention mm-hmm. is where our life happens. Mm-hmm. And so if we're always putting our attention on the negative, if we're always drawing the children's attention to the negative, to the unskillful, they're going to develop that negativity bias. It's going to be strengthened. Mm. But if we turn our attention always to the skillful and overlook as much as we can, mm-hmm. overlook as much as we can, and then represent later at a neutral moment, mm-hmm. then that's really how we support that. And that's how we support self-efficacy. It's so much about getting rid of stress. You know, don't correct, represent. Mm-hmm. And recognize that every child has gifts to bring, even if they're really challenging, really challenging to work with.
Julie, I could talk to you for another 6 hours. Just want you to know, I am enjoying this conversation so much. And for those of you listening, we are so excited to share that Julia will be presenting at our conference, our Deepening Our Practice Baltimore Montessori Conference, this June. The work that you're doing is so important, Julia, where you're marrying Montessori and brain research. And what a gift to the whole Montessori movement to have those foundational elements behind what we're doing every day in our classrooms. This work is so important, and we need you to continue to do this work so you can help us understand how the brain is responding to what it is that we're doing.
I would say the best way that we can all help is to recognize ourselves as scientists and professionals. We're not daycare providers.
Mm-hmm.
We are scientists, and we are teaching at the level beyond the university level. And if each of us approaches our teaching environments, our practice, using the scientific method, trying to be precise, trying to be consistent, you know, staying positive, focusing our attention where we want the child's attention to focus, all of those things are the scientific method. And so it's really about us recognizing that this is a neurodevelopmental pedagogy. It's not a guru pedagogy. It's about us being scientists.
I love that. I love that. And so I want you to know that Julia's MyTree Learning has wonderful products. Highly recommend if you haven't checked those out. High quality, very developmentally appropriate, and you can trust everything that you purchase from there, which is saying something really important. And I just want to say thank you so much, Julia, for your spending your time with us today. We so appreciate your expertise. We so appreciate what you're doing out in the world. And it's really been so fun to spend this time with you.
I've enjoyed it too. I'm grateful to be here and have the opportunity. I hope it helps. I hope it helps.
Me too. And to our listeners, we invite you to subscribe to our podcast to hear the latest episodes and to join in the conversation on both Facebook and Instagram. You can take a look at our website, greenspringcenter.org, to view the show notes from today's episode, to learn more about Julia, to find information on her website and contact information so that you can follow up with her as well. We invite you to take a look at our conference, which is coming up. And if you are new to Montessori, we're excited to have a mentorship conversation for you in the fall as well. Thank you for spending time with us today. The work you do, Montessorians, is so very important, and we're here to help. Join us next week.